Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, also known as What Lex?
The Alternate History Podcast.
The Alternate History Podcast. Today we're going to take just a really short trip back in time to an event that's sort of timely. We'll talk about why it's sort of timely. Netflix. People perhaps have heard of Netflix. Alexis?
Kind of popular.
Has produced, like many of the other streaming networks, has produced their own original show. And one of the original shows they've had a tremendous amount of success with is what?
That'd be The Crown.
The Crown. And why would you have any interest in The Crown, Alexis?
It centers around this family. You might have heard of them, the British royal family.
The British royal family. And in fact, as we are recording this episode now, it's been, I guess, just slightly over a week since the premiere of season 4. And I've had the opportunity to see a couple of episodes of The Crown, and season 4 of The Crown takes us pretty far forward in the timeline, considering where they started in season 1, which of course is at the time of Elizabeth, or shortly before Elizabeth II, assuming the throne. And so as we get to season 4 here, what time frame have we pulled up into, Lex?
We'd be in the 80s.
Yeah, in the late 70s and into the early 80s. And one of the most notable events for the royal family in the early 80s would be what?
There was this wedding of Prince Charles and this woman called Lady Diana Spencer.
Yeah. It was the quote-unquote wedding of the century.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually one of the meeting and the engagement and the lead-up to that is all part of what is emphasized in season 4 of The Crown, which is what sort of motivated us to record this episode and record this as a topic.
Yeah, I actually didn't pick this topic despite what the topic is. Surprise, surprise.
That's true. I suggested as we were getting ready to record or thinking about what we might record that it might be timely. That was one of the reasons for doing it. It's certainly in getting public attention right now because of the premiere of season 4, but also because I also knew Alexis would be prepared for it almost without being prepared for it, which is sort of an interesting good place to be. So what we're going to look at today as far as the historical what if is what would have happened if the wedding had not happened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're going to look at that when we come back from this break. We hope that you stick with us and we talk about something that really is not as much history as it is gossip, but we're going to see that it does, I think, have some historical overtones as we get down into it, particularly for the British royal family. So we'll be right back after this break.
Would groceries delivered to you in as fast as 1 hour save you a trip to the store? Instacart makes that possible thanks to personal shoppers in your area who hand-select items based on your preferences from the stores you love. And shopping multiple stores is possible on a single order. Instacart picks the freshest produce and even keeps your eggs safe, all while finding everything you usually buy, providing smart suggestions for new items, and even highlighting deals to help you save money. And now you get free delivery on your first order over $35. Let Instacart know we sent you and help support our show by following the link in the show notes. Instacart. Groceries delivered in as fast as 1 hour.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Alexis and
Don
here to talk about a timely topic, as we talked about before the break. On today's show, we're going to be discussing the wedding of Prince Charles and Lady Diana Spencer. And because we are an alternate history podcast, we're going to be talking about what if that wedding had not taken place.
Yeah, what if that wedding had not taken place? Now, there's a couple of different ways that we could branch off for this departure. One would be simply that the wedding did not take place between the two of them because he married someone
else.
As is well known, well publicized now, in fact, his now current wife, than previously his mistress,
mm-hmm.
Would be the person that we know as Camilla
Parker Bowles.
Parker Bowles had been Charles' love interest, I guess,
Before she was Camilla Parker Bowles, actually. Yeah. She was Camilla Shand. Yeah.
For a decade before the wedding here in 1981 that we're focusing on. So we could just look at, and we may talk about what the alternative would have been if he'd just chosen someone other than Diana Spencer to be his bride. But we're specifically going to focus in because of some of the things that have been, that are out in the media now and have been publicized about, partly, I think, because of the show. That's why it's come around to be somewhat something of a media topic right now, is apparently what happened on it, based upon things that she told people, she being the late Princess Diana, what she told people happened the night before the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
What was that?
Charles conveniently told her, "I don't love you."
Which is not normally what you hear
right from before a wedding.
From your prospective groom, right?
Not normally.
Yeah. And it's interesting to note that, you know, I was telling Alexis that I remember I was 13 at the time they got married, and certainly not as a 13-year-old young man, was not exactly love struck.
Gung-ho to get up and watch the wedding.
Yeah, but it was an event. It was going to be broadcast live, and in fact, the estimates are that it was seen by somewhere around 750 million people around the world, which makes it about as watched for that particular time as you would have for the opening ceremonies of Olympic Games. This was an international broadcast event. Again, dubbed the Wedding of the Century, a fairy tale wedding. So from the outside, it was, I guess, what every... If I'd been a 13-year-old girl, I probably would have been, who knows?
All for it.
All for it. But here's this young 19-year-old Diana, who is marrying the older 30-year-old Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's a huge media event. It's a huge public relations event for the monarchy. All of these things that are going on. But to now discover that what we were seeing on the outside of what may have been really going on were not exactly the same thing.
Correct.
So what do you know about all of that, Alexis?
So we have heard that the night before, Charles does say to Diana, "I don't love you." Charles was pressured into this wedding by several people in his family, most notably probably his father.
Right.
The Duke of Edinburgh.
And why would there be pressure on Charles to get married?
Well, as you mentioned, he is 30. So he's the heir to the throne, in his 30s, unmarried. It's kind of assumed you need to settle down, you need to start making some heirs, you need to start getting ready to take your place in the world and in the line of succession.
As heir apparent, and of course Elizabeth has lived a very long life now,
yes.
But even at this time she's not exactly young.
No. She would be in her 60s.
Right, at this time. So, there's been pressure. There's pressure put on him. It's time, is sort of the way that it's expressed. Shortly before that, back again, we'll reference The Crown here a lot. This is part of the motivation for this. The opening episode of season 4 relates around the assassination, the boat bombing that ends up killing...
Lord Mountbatten.
Lord Mountbatten, who is, I'm trying to think exactly what he is to Charles. He is Charles's...
Would you be a third cousin?
He's his great uncle, right?
That too.
Yeah.
He's doubly related.
Right. Because this is his father's uncle. So it's his great uncle, and definitely known to be a influence,
yes,
on the family. The family knew him as Dickie, and he's killed in a bombing that responsibility is claimed for by the Irish Republican Army. And was very close to Charles, almost as is in the show, and I think is fairly considered true in real life, was almost more of a father to Charles than Prince
Philip
is, or considered to be. And so the pressure is put on by Charles's father, Prince Philip. You know, it's time for you to, it's time, you need to get married. There had been a series of suitors, a series of possible women who were considered, and ultimately when this budding relationship starts to happen with a young Diana... apparently it happens very quickly, and as a result, they're engaged, and it's not much longer that they're married.
Correct.
Yeah, and again, to put this in perspective, she apparently told one interviewer that they had only dated or seen each other or essentially been around each other something like 13 times before the before the actual...
Before the engagement.
Before the proposal.
Uh-huh.
And was a little, apparently, as some folks have written now, of course, a lot has been written about Diana. We did an episode about what would have happened if she had not died in the tunnel crash in Paris. But it was, a lot is known now about the fact that this was sort of whirlwind. It caught her by surprise all of a sudden. But one of the things about her is that she was considered an acceptable match.
Yes.
So what makes you acceptable to be married to the future King of England, or at least the heir apparent to the throne?
You would be an aristocratic English virgin. Diana ticked all the boxes.
And I guess the other thing, we always end up touching on this, it seems like when we talk about the British monarchy, you needed to be Protestant.
Yes.
Because up until, well, even recently, even in the last year when they changed some of the rules regarding the succession, it's still the case that you cannot be...
You cannot be a Roman Catholic, but now you can marry a Roman Catholic.
Right. Which before, if you married a Roman Catholic, you were removed.
You lost your place.
You were removed from the line of succession. So there were certain boxes that you had to tick, and you had to be of a certain station, obviously, to be considered a proper wife. That's been relaxed a little bit now. Certainly for Harry, for example,
not just Harry, William too.
Yeah. So that changed, but still, this is very much the case in 1980 and 81.
Yes.
So
notice I said Lady Diana Spencer earlier.
Right. So we won't go too far down this path, and we'll come back around again to the historical what if. We're still setting up the historical what did here. But in the historical what if Charles had had his way, who would he have been married to?
That'd be Camilla.
Who he's now married to now.
Yes.
Okay. And the reason that they were not married was what?
She was not acceptable. She was not aristocratic.
Okay. And so she marries someone else
mm-hmm.
in 73. It's sort of widely reported, and I guess widely known now to be a fact, that they engaged in...
They were having an affair.
Right. After she was married, but before he's married to Diana, and then that resumes at some point after the marriage to Diana, the famous... Now, we were talking about the 1995 interview with Diana and Martin Bashir, where Diana, quote-unquote, says there were three in the marriage. It was a little...
Bit crowded,
as she said. So all of that eventually comes. But this is not the case in 1981.
Mm-mm.
In 1981, if you're the world, what do you look and what do you see here?
Fairy tale.
Yeah. So this was... Is it a fair thing to say this was a big PR event for the crown?
Yes.
And how so and why so?
Again, this is explored a little bit in The Crown, or I think it's being set up to be explored a little bit in The Crown. In the 80s, we have a lot of upheaval and a lot of angst in Britain going on. We have Margaret Thatcher. She gets elected Prime Minister in 1979, and she institutes sweeping reforms that lead to strikes, that lead to unemployment, several different things. So the monarchy, the government in general, was not on very good footing with the British public. So this wedding was kind of seen as a booster to bring the monarchy back into a positive light with the British public.
And there was a lot of pressure, I guess, that it even started to form. They've been going on for a while about we're now into a modern society. It's multiple years removed from World War II. The Commonwealth has started to go its separate ways. Britain's no longer a global empire.
Mm-hmm.
And so why do we still have this institution?
Yeah, this outdated institution.
That costs money.
Yes.
Right. And so that's sort of where things are set in 1981. So that sort of brings us, I think, pretty effectively up to the what did without spending tons of time on the what did.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what we said we were going to explore is our what if, and I'm gonna choose not the did he marry someone else path. We may end up going down that path inadvertently because of where we're going to go. But we're actually going to break on the fact of the night before, apparently the last time they see each other, as the story is sort of told today, Charles did not want to enter into the marriage under false pretense. And so that's why he tells her that he really doesn't
love her.
And so apparently he was anxious to maybe not go through with the wedding. And now she has a reason to not be anxious to go through the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So the first point of departure here is, let's assume a scenario, or what the scenario might have been if Charles had been the one that says this is not going to happen. What might have happened under that set of circumstances?
I think very much in what did happen and why he was pressured to marry Diana in the first place. I think if Charles is the one to say, well, I'm not doing this, I think you would have seen the family swoop in and say, oh, yes, you are. So I think you, but it might have been this like kind of like long drawn out and would have become public scenario. I mean, you have that kind of flashpoint the night before the wedding. I don't love you, but we're still going to go through with this because we kind of have to. If Charles says, I'm not going through with this, you're going to end up in this tug of war with the family of, oh, yes, you are, because we say you are. But it's going to go on, and I think it's going to become public, and the British public is going to see that.
So he would have had to object, at least in the way that you analyze that or think about that, he would have had to object to that well before the night before.
Yes.
Because he certainly understood that pulling the plug, oh, by the way, tomorrow, I know the world, I know 750 million people around the world have set their alarms.
Are expecting me to be at St. Paul's Cathedral.
Because one of the things interesting to note there is, again, this is 1981, and while VCRs were not unheard of, they were not
really popular.
Really
yet.
Popular. I mean, I remember setting my alarm to get up, not setting the VCR to record it so that I could get up and then watch it, which I would have done later, or, you know, the ways that we would deal with that, we would time shift for our own convenience now, although a lot of people probably still would get up. But literally it was, there's 750 million people around the world that are
getting up
or that are planning to tune in inside of the United Kingdom to watch this. So the idea that, you know, that morning you wake up and you tune into the coverage and it's, oh, by the way,
This isn't happening.
At least if it had been Charles that had been the one that had pulled the plug, it's hard to imagine that would have been allowed to go. You said family pressure, the pressure of the institution, all the other things would have prevented that from likely happening.
Yeah.
Okay. So skipping over the situation where Charles pulls the plug, Diana may have known that things weren't exactly
peachy
and fantastic, but to actually hear those words uttered to her the night before, she's not part of the institution yet.
Correct.
So do you think she has a little bit more flexibility and a little bit more optionality here?
I think she does, but I also think, and keep in mind, prior to the wedding, and we kind of talked about this in the episode we did talking about her death in 97, she's already been hounded by the British press, by the British public, while she's been engaged. So if she's suddenly pulling the plug, it's not like those people are magically just going to fade into the woodwork and go away. She's still going to be an object of obsession for people, probably even more so, because they really want to know what happened, why she pulled the plug. So, I mean, Diana does have a little bit more leeway to pull the plug because she is not part of the institution, but she is already connected and interwoven into things and can't just pluck herself out of it with no repercussions at all.
Right. So, you know, the interesting thing to me is I start trying to speculate this through, and of course it's a lot of what if inside of the what if, but assuming that she says, that night, you know, she makes the call to, I don't even know who she would have made the call to. Who do you call when you're backing out of the royal wedding?
Well, she was staying with the Queen Mother. She was at Clarence House the night before her wedding. So maybe you tell the Queen Mother. She'll get a message to the Queen.
Yeah. And so at some point, someone has to make it knowledge inside of the institution. I keep talking about the royal family here as the institution, inside of the inside there. But then somebody has to make it known to the press and to the media. You're all here, but
what you think is going to happen is not going to happen.
Yeah. And so, you know, can easily imagine the 6, 7, 8 hours of coverage, whatever it was that day. I mean, it was an extended piece of coverage. Then turning into the great, you know, what if in terms of, you know, they would have then been analyzing what happened and, you know, trying to get a hold of people and all the things that would have gone with that. So one of the what ifs is that day. That day would have just turned into absolute
pandemonium.
Pandemonium and chaos. But so let's say at some point that day, word just sort of gets out that there'd been a discussion the night before, the two of them realized they really weren't ready to become man and wife. How much sympathy do you think would be expressed by the public at large of, well, yeah, it's an inconvenience for us because we bought all the plates and all the paraphernalia and we got up, but it's better that they not get married if they really shouldn't get married, right?
I think there wouldn't have been a lot of sympathy for Charles.
So you think Diana would have garnered most of the sympathy under that scenario?
I think so.
And why do you think that?
Again, it's that thing of the monarchy is not on the best footing right now. And especially if it comes to, like, Charles is the one that said, I don't love you. I think you would have had the public rallying to Diana's corner, like, you know, she's been wrong. She's been gypped. She's this poor girl who was taken in and now by the evil institution, and look what happened to her. I think there wouldn't have been a lot of sympathy for Charles. I think maybe the only person who might have had sympathy for Charles, Camilla, maybe?
So, again, that's assuming that day. I think the same thing would be true even if it's a week later, a couple of weeks later. As the story gets out, who was going to come out as the villain in this story?
Definitely Charles.
Yeah, for reasons that had caused him to even be in the situation in the first place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, under that scenario, again, we're looking at our what-if here. I know we're interspacing a lot of what did with the what-if, but the what-if is it doesn't happen that day, so it's called off. There's obviously the pandemonium of that day. It's as big a news story that it doesn't happen as it actually happened. In fact, it actually becomes a bigger news story in terms of being an ongoing story, and I think not just in the United Kingdom, because, again, this had captured
the world's
imagination and the world's attention. So let's imagine that over the next 2 to 3 weeks, the situation that we're talking about here, slowly but surely, it sort of gets out. Well, there was, you know, there was tension. There probably would be, well, maybe they'll change their mind. Maybe they'll actually do it. But eventually it comes to the point of they break the engagement or it becomes official. So let's say that happens 2 to 3 weeks after the event, because I'm sure there would have been efforts to try to patch it up, get it back online. You know,
oh, it's just cold feet. You're fine.
Yeah. She's 19. She's young. All the things that would have gone with that. But let's say 3 weeks after again. So again, that event happens in late July. So let's say by the end of August, we now definitely know there's not going to be a royal wedding. There's definitely not going to be a royal wedding between Charles and Diana. So now that we've reached that particular what if, where is the monarchy in terms of how they recover from that? Do they recover? Is this a more enduring blow to them than just a really bad public relations event that takes a couple of months to run through the cycle?
I think this is a more enduring blow, specifically if you've got this 2-3 week period of will they, won't they, what's going on. I think it's more of a direct blow to the monarchy. The monarchy, as we talked about, was not already on the best footing. Now we've gone through this 2-3 week period of wishy-washy, what's happening, what's going on. Okay, we're not going to do it. We're not going to get married. So I think it's not at all out of the realm of possibility that you start having people starting to ask for the abolition of the monarchy, to start questioning why do we even have this institution, to start calling for a republic. We've already had the Irish Republican Army. We talked about the assassination of Lord Mountbatten. So I think those feelings would have definitely bubbled to the surface, and it's possible that we might have ended up with no monarchy.
And so that's one extreme situation.
Mm-hmm.
If that happens, what really happens? I mean, this is... Yes, it's a constitutional monarchy. Yes, it has a democratically elected prime minister and government, but it still is a monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean? I mean, England's been a monarchy
since
there's been an England, right?
Well, we had that one little brief period, but you know, yeah, that's a really interesting question. My mind automatically goes to some kind of system like the United States, where don't know if they would necessarily call it a president, but they do have a prime minister. Their legislature is actually set up in quite the same way that the United States legislature is set up. It's got two houses headed by a prime minister, which is not the same, but sort of similar to our president, with differences. But it, to me, I think the natural evolution would be kind of the same system as the U.S., where you have the prime minister leading the country with the two-house legislature that's elected by the people. And you just don't have this other overseeing body.
So they just eliminate... You think they just eliminate the monarchy?
I think so.
Does it happen immediately? Does it... Well, we're going to let Elizabeth finish out her reign, but there's going, you know, once Elizabeth's dead, the monarchy's over. I mean, How do you stop, aside from a revolution?
True.
How do you stop having a monarchy?
My head naturally wants to say, just, you know, let Elizabeth finish her reign. However, with the benefit of hindsight, necessarily, we're talking about something in the 80s, now we're in 2020, we know Elizabeth is still alive. She's 94. So, if we're just letting Elizabeth continue her reign, and we'll be done whenever Elizabeth is done, we're in 2020, she's still going.
We're 39 years removed from that event.
Correct. So, it's quite easy, and it also reminds me, kind of similar to the Commonwealth. The head of the Commonwealth is Elizabeth II, but it's not 100% guaranteed that Charles is going to succeed her. They have to elect the next head. They ended up picking Charles. Charles will succeed, but that wasn't set in stone. So, there was kind of this talk about, from some countries in the Commonwealth, of, we're just going to let Elizabeth finish out her reign, and then we'll be out of the Commonwealth after that.
Because all she technically is for member states of the Commonwealth is the head of state.
Right.
Which is a symbolic role.
Correct.
Viewed to be an important role, but symbolic.
Symbolic, yes.
Right.
So, again, that's where my brain wants to go of, oh, just let her finish it out, and then we'll get rid of it. But again, this is 81, and we're talking 2020, and she's still the head of state. So we're, as you mentioned, we're 39 years removed from that event. So that's where my brain is struggling, because I know how long she's reigned. So it's hard for me to be like, oh, just let her finish. She's only got a few more years left. No, a few is 39 and counting.
Right. So if it doesn't happen that way, and it doesn't happen immediately, I guess the other possibility is there remains the institution, but the institution somehow gets altered by this event.
It could become that they are just 100% ornamental and just a figurehead and have, I mean, another thing the Queen does is she has weekly meetings with the Prime Minister. Do those stop? And it's just like, you're in your palace, you're on our money, that's fine. You have these pretty palaces that we can go visit, that's okay. But you don't do anything. You just are in your palace, and we, you know, have parades for you every once in a while. I think that could be kind of the transition phase of, like, you can still be in power, or you can still be on the throne, but you won't have any power.
Yeah, because there are other European monarchies that are democratic countries that have different, slightly different relationships in terms of how the monarchy expresses itself.
Right.
Without getting into all the details of that. So the other possibility would be that you have this decline of the monarchy exists because it's traditional, it continues to exist, but it just fades and fades and fades and fades and fades.
Right.
And goes down from there. And of course, the other thing that happens is, but in the real timeline, Charles and Diana marry.
Yes.
And very shortly thereafter, within the span of
a year,
what happens?
We have an heir.
We have an heir, and it's a male heir.
Mm-hmm.
So Charles has done the thing that he is most supposed to do, right? Which,
yes,
is sustain the...
He secured the bloodline. We're good.
Right. And then not only that, you know, there's the famous heir and a spare.
And one came along 2 years later.
Yeah, so you have William and you have Harry. And so that's taken care of. And then, of course, what you have there is this public relations... The 80s. I can remember... Growing up during that period of time, it was hard not to turn on the TV and see who?
Diana.
Because not only was she, you know, royalty and had made the splash on the scene, you know, being the young fairy tale wedding bride to young boys, she gets involved in social causes and is, in fact, many of the things that are later portrayed, for example, in another piece of popular media, the Queen. Mm-hmm. You know, it sort of reaches the point where Diana is, from a media standpoint, eclipses,
yes,
a great portion of the royal family just because of styles and age and difference and things that are there. And so the good news for the royal family in the 80s is Diana gives the whole institution this modern spin public relations boost. The problem is in the 1980s that Diana gives the whole institution this
boost,
modern spin public relations boost, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, again, now chasing a slightly different what-if, we'll cover this after we take another quick break here. We're going to come back and talk about, after they would have recovered from this event, what might have happened subsequently. We'll be back in just a second.
Taking a little break from the podcast today, this is Alexis and Don here to remind you to be a lazy podcast listener like I am.
A lazy podcast listener?
Well, I don't want to work for it. I wanted to just appear in my feed. And there's an easy way to do that. What is that?
That would be subscribing, perhaps?
Absolutely. If you click that little subscribe button at the top of our page in your podcatcher of choice, you do not have to worry about the podcast going to download it. Oh, is there a new episode this week? It just appears. It's magic.
It's magic. It's podcasting magic, I tell ya. In most podcatchers, it's difficult to actually listen to a podcast without subscribing to it. So I understand we may be talking about something you say, yeah, why is this important? It's still not automatic, and you still may need to adjust the settings even on that particular subscription. I know that's true in the podcatcher that I use. If I'm not careful, I will only hear the default settings are like the last three episodes,
yep.
Or won't keep episodes for a period of time. And so the two things we want to encourage you to do is if you enjoy the podcast, like Alexis says, invoke some A Fork in Time podcast magic and subscribe to the podcast, but then also tweak the settings to really match what you do with the podcast as well.
Yeah, you can change how many episodes it saves. You can change it so that it deletes the episode after you listen to it. There's tons of different settings that you can go in and tweak a little bit, but just make sure you hit that subscribe button so you don't have to do any work. It just shows up in your feed.
And you don't miss an episode that way. You know when it's there. We actually, one of the things I'm most proud of here at A Fork in Time is the regularity of our releases. We did change our release date by one day at one point to push it later into the week. But other than that change, since we started this thing over a year and a half ago, we have consistently met a weekly production schedule. And that's not always easy. I see Alexis actually smiling about that from across the recording desk here. But one of the things about the reason we do that is I know for the podcast that I subscribe to, I want them showing up in my podcast catcher.
Yeah, and if they don't, I'm like, where is it? It's not here. I get a little concerned. So, I understand that and I get it.
So we just want to take a quick moment to strongly recommend that if you like A Fork in Time, make sure that you always get A Fork in Time. And we may surprise you at some point one week and drop an extra episode in. You want to know when it shows.
Absolutely.
All right, so go and subscribe. Thanks. Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Don Alexis today, tromping down the 1981, what if there had been no royal wedding of the century, what if? And so before the break, we were talking about just some of the potential implications on the institution of the crown itself had the wedding not gone through. Let's shift over to the people that were involved in this. So, what do you think happens to a Diana, separate now from the institution of the crown, but having someone who has gained public notoriety and other things as well? What do we know of a Diana that was never Princess of Wales?
Well, because she's lived... She has had the benefit of being a royal fiancé, just not a royal wife and a princess. So she's gotten a taste of publicity, of media, and she knows how to work it. That's why she's so popular in the 80s and even into the early 90s before her untimely death. So I think if you have a Diana that is completely taken out of the institution of monarchy, but she had that flavor and she had that taste of media and the attention and what it could do for her. I think because she was so socially minded and things like that, I think you would have this... She would still almost be competing with the royals just out of the royal family because she had become popular, people knew who she was, so even without the Princess of Wales title, she would still be able to use that platform that she'd built while she was engaged to the Prince of Wales, if that makes any sense.
No, I think it does. So now let's look at the Charles path post the pulling the plug on the wedding.
I think you have a not popular Charles. I think he would have retreated into his shell. This is, again, you said we were going to mention the crown a lot, and we're mentioning the crown. Charles was a shy person. He's always been a little more reserved, a little more, I don't want to call him a recluse. He's not a recluse, but he is more reserved. He is not as flamboyant, not as outgoing as Diana was. So I think if you have a Charles that's now having to deal with a broken engagement and a broken engagement where he is perceived to be in the wrong, I think you are going to have this even more of a retreat into a shell. And it's, I think it's not impossible that he goes and tells his mom, you know what? I'm giving up my right to the throne. I don't want it. I want to go live my life. I don't want to do this.
So he chooses not to pursue marriage or whatever. He just chooses to, I'm out.
I can see that as a possibility. I think he does have a sense of duty. And I think he would still continue with some of the causes he was passionate about. We know he's passionate about sustainability, about the environment and things like that. I don't think he would have just completely gone into the wilderness and you never would have heard from him. But I think you would have seen him take himself out of the royal equation and just kind of focus on those things. Separate from that, because I think he would have seen the royal responsibilities as a little too much to bear, especially dealing with this fallout from this broken engagement and the ramifications that came from that.
So one of the options would be that he spins off into whatever he spins off into.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the other possibility is he's not allowed to do that because of duty and honor and everything else. So how likely do you think it is that then there's another quick effort to find now, okay, he needed to get this done. He didn't get this done with her. Now we definitely have to find the right one.
Yes.
How much is there a possibility of that, do you think?
There'd be, if he wasn't allowed to kind of go off and do his own thing, I think there would have been a quadrupling down, not a doubling, not a tripling, quadrupling down. Like, we got to find the right one because she wasn't it. She's out there somewhere. He's got to find her. He's got to do his duty. So let's figure out who this is supposed to be.
Do you have any idea? Obviously, other than Camilla, we're going to come back to Camilla here in a minute. But other than Camilla, I mean, I know there were others that he was connected with and, you know, associated with. Do you think somebody had a list somewhere, Philip or Elizabeth or somebody had a list somewhere of, okay, this is where we're going to go next?
I'm sure there probably was a list, and Diana was not the only aristocratic daughter in the entire country. Of course, we watched an episode of The Crown last night, and Anne, his sister, does say, like, we ran the length of Britain. She was the perfect one. Just make it work. But I think there were other options in Britain, so I think there would have been, yeah, whoever has the list, pull the list out, and let's go down it and figure out who the next person is, because we got to get this done.
So what amount of time passes between July of 81 and when there's the next royal wedding, whatever that looks like in your mind?
The month that immediately popped in my head was November. That is the month of Charles's birth. So now we would have been dealing with a 31-year-old. Heir to the throne that was not married, so it's, I could see either a wedding in November or at least an engagement announcement in November to coincide with his birthday.
So you think within a year there would have been the next expectation?
I mean, think about, you mentioned the time period between when Charles and Diana meet and their engagement, 13 times. So between July and November, he could have found somebody to go on 13 dates with.
Okay, so I'm going to now circle back around to the third person in the marriage that wasn't. Is there any scenario that once it gets out that probably the reason Charles did this, because it wasn't like it wasn't in the public sphere to some degree about Camilla at the time, maybe not as widely known as it is
now
by any stretch of the imagination. Do you think there's any possibility of the public softening up to the idea that Charles is something of the victim here because he wasn't allowed to marry who that he wanted to marry, and I don't know when exactly she, when her marriage to the Bowles of
Andrew
Bowles ends, but that there's any sympathy that swings back towards Charles at some point that he's allowed to perhaps consider going down a different path that may have actually matched him up with who he considers to be his love match?
I think there would have been a little bit of sympathy for Charles. You are right. The relationship he had with Camilla was not, I don't want to say widely known, but it was not a secret. People were aware of it. I think the thing that would have stopped that is the fact that Camilla went and got married to somebody else. So if you had had this, Camilla was still single, Charles is single, has broken off this engagement, like, oh, let's get the two lovebirds together. You would have had that. I think what stops that is the fact that Camilla had gone and gotten married to somebody else. Now, granted, again, in The Crown, it's kind of suggested that possibly the royal family was involved in engendering that marriage and making that marriage happen to kind of get Camilla out of the way. I'm not sure how factual that is, so I'm not going to chase that rabbit or pretend to know something I don't know. But again, because Camilla has gotten married to somebody else, I think that sympathy for Charles and Camilla as kind of these lovebirds, these forlorn lovebirds, wouldn't have been quite there, because it's like, well, she didn't wait, so why should we be sympathizing this?
And I was just looking here. She actually doesn't divorce until 95, which, of course, is after...
they're separated. They're not divorced yet.
Right, yeah. in terms of the marriage between Charles and Diana. So your thinking would be that if Charles doesn't spin off and to sort of go off into exiting the institution, there probably is the public relations need to repair and quickly get him into a quote unquote proper marriage
relationship.
Yeah. And sort of repair things from that point moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say they're not able to do that. Again, we're now talking about the what ifs. I mean, we mentioned before, was there really a chance here that the monarchy would succumb because of other pressures that were already on the monarchy, and this was just sort of the straw that broke the camel's back?
I think it has to be that. I don't think this is not the single instance that's going to break the monarchy, but because of the piling on of things, I think that phrase is exactly right. I think this would have been the straw that broke the camel's back. If this is just the last thing that is kind of heaped on this, we're done. We're done. Again, I don't think this one specific instance, it would have been a PR nightmare for the monarchy, for sure. But this one instance alone couldn't have broken the monarchy, but when you compile it with everything else that was going on with the monarchy at the time, I think it would have been the final straw and kind of the tipping point of like, no, okay, this isn't worth this anymore.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, the last thing I sort of want to close out on here is this thought of, at the end of the day, as has been well portrayed in all types of popular media and publicized as well, and of course her untimely and tragic death, would they have been better? I guess the question I'm going to pose to you, Alexis, this is a lot more of an opinion episode of our podcast than it is, you know, running through all the possibilities because of the nature of what it is. Net plus, would they have been better off with the way things actually, as an institution, talk about the monarchy here.
Okay.
Things did not end well for Diana, no matter what, in the real timeline. But would the institution have been better off with this 1981... public relations hit of a plug pulled on the wedding as compared to the drama, the soap opera, you might even say, that became Charles and Diana's marriage and everything about that, the divorce, all that that meant for the, you know, the future King of England suddenly to find himself, you know, separated and then ultimately divorced. Some question about whether he could be even in that role, for example, if he were to remarry. If you had to choose between the two options, you're only given those two choices. Would have been more damaging to the crown, or which one actually played out better for them?
As weird as this is going to probably, well, I don't know if this is going to sound weird. I think the better scenario is the wedding happens in 81. And the reason I say that is, again, the benefit of hindsight, we're now living in 2020. I think that specifically the two best things that come out of that marriage are William and Harry. If we don't have the wedding in 81, we don't have a William, we don't have a Harry. And we, William and Harry, partly because of the influence of their mother, partly because of the tragic way that she died, but they have a lot of their mother's traits in them, and I think they have done a lot of good to bolster the image of the monarchy. So, as crazy as the 80s and the 90s were, with the madness that were Charles and Diana and their drama, I think getting to, let's say, 99-2000, I think you have the monarchy in a very good stead because of William and Harry. And you don't have William and Harry without Diana. So I think Diana is better than not having Diana at all.
Okay. That's fair enough. Anything else you want to say about this topic?
Well, you got up in 81. I got up in 2011.
And you got up for what?
I got up for William and Kate's wedding.
That's probably a good thing for us to close out on, because that actually did run through my mind briefly. Do you think in some ways that William and Kate's wedding was... It was the next generation, literally, the next generation's version of that 1981 fairy tale wedding?
Definitely. It was also billed the wedding of the century. I think it was, and I remember when, in the lead up to their wedding and when they actually got married, there were so many callbacks to Diana. Where they got married was Westminster Abbey, which is where her funeral was. I remember one of the hymns they played was also played, I think, at her funeral. So there were a lot of these callbacks to Diana. So yeah, I think it was kind of a bookend of this whole chapter of Diana and Charles get married in 81. There's this nightmare travesty of a situation that happens between 81 and 2011. It's kind of this, okay, we made it.
Yeah, and then in some ways that William and Kate are sort of representative of the Charles and Diana that did, they're the Charles and Diana the way that Charles and Diana everyone had hoped would turn out.
Correct. And I think, again, in the lead up to William and Catherine's wedding, there were a lot of discussions about the reason why their courtship was so long. I mean, they met in 2004, I think, if I'm remembering my timeline correctly, 2005. Maybe even earlier than that. And one of the things William said was the reason why this courtship was so long was because I wanted Kate to be able to back out. I wanted to be able for Kate to see the things that my mother dealt with. Because, again, 13 times that they met, Diana didn't know what she was getting into. Kate walked into that marriage with her eyes wide open.
Right. And, of course, a very different time. You know, a different media climate, a different, you know, things are different. Time has passed. I guess the last thing this just popped into my head, so I don't want to close out without closing out on this. Is Charles rehabilitated despite all of this?
You know, I think he is. And I'll close out on this. I remember when Charles and Camilla got married. That was 2005. They met in 2001, William and Kate. Charles and Camilla got married in 2005. I remember when they got married, and I remember it took me a long time. I want to say maybe until William and Kate got married in 2011 to come around on the idea of Camilla. I did not like her. I actually used to refer to her as that woman. I will admit to that. But I think watching them together, watching Charles, he's become more settled. He's become more at ease. He's become more aware of his role and how he fits into the monarchy in general. I think he has been rehabilitated. Now, you're always going to have those people that are going to see him as, you know, a villain or in a negative light. But I think he has rehabilitated himself. And I think Camilla has rehabilitated herself. Again, I don't call her that woman anymore. I now recognize that she has her own qualities and has her own goodness within her, even though she was kind of seen as this villain and this third person in this marriage for 10 years.
And I guess, you know, the thing that we started this talk, the topic was suggested in terms of doing it because of what's going on in popular media. This thing's a very popular show that's about, you know, the history of this very public family and how they've reached the point in that talking about that. you know, but the realization that, again, thinking about this idea, and maybe rehabilitation is a strong word to put on Charleston, but that may be a poor choice of words for me. So particularly any of our English listeners, I apologize for that if that's offensive. Part of it is we don't have a king over here, so, you know, our queen. So it's hard for us sometimes to get our head around that, and we have entirely other things, but that's an entirely different thing too. But this idea, what I do distinctly remember, particularly during the period of time when there was the discussion of a separation and what that would even mean, certainly the divorce, all the other things that were there, but this literally this idea of, would Charles be skipped over, particularly once Elizabeth has lived such a long life, and William had grown to the age of majority,
mm-hmm.
Where it was a logical thing to even think or imagine that, you know, it might be the case of, on Elizabeth's death or whatever would cause her to have to no longer exercise the powers of the monarchy, but it would just sort of skip past Charles and go directly on down to William. I remember that being distinctly discussed.
It's still a thing. I was at the grocery store a couple of days ago, and it was a tabloid, so of course there was no credibility to it, but it was like, Elizabeth is retiring, and guess who she's picking to be her successor? I mean, it's still a thing. There is still a camp for Charles is not a king, William is the next monarch.
Even though William is not next in line to the throne, he is the subsequent in line to the throne.
Yep.
And so, you know, I raise that because I think, you know, one of the other interesting things that ties back to the topic, which is why I brought it up, is that William benefits from a lot of things. And one of the things that William benefits from, you talked about his demeanor and some of the skill set that he has. He benefits from being Diana's son.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, and of course, now deceased, almost martyred Diana's son. I mean, one of the interesting things I was, you know, part of what caused me to want to have this, do this recording this week was not just the premiere of The Crown and this being the topic there, but there has been tremendous amount of press attention to how, in, theoretically, that famous 1995 interview with Bashir, Martin Bashir, where Diana was somehow ambushed in that interview. And I've seen, you know, the remarks from, I guess, both William and Harry talk now defending their mother's honor and her position and everything else that goes with that. So it's been 1997 was Diana's death, correct?
Yes.
So we are now 23 years removed from that, over 23 years removed. And so she still casts that shadow on the monarchy. It's a fair thing to say that one of the things that did happen that day, because this wedding went through, because we didn't explore the what if, because it actually happened, is the monarchy, we've suggested, might have been changed if the wedding didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
What is definitely the case is the monarchy was changed.
Because it did.
Either way, that was, you know, July 29th of 1981 was a watershed moment in the modern British monarchy for all kinds of reasons.
Yep.
I think that's a fair thing to say. All right. Anything else before we close out, Lex?
I think that's everything.
All right. Once again, we thank you for joining us today. This will be released on or about the time of Thanksgiving in the United States. And so if you're listening to this and you've just enjoyed that holiday, we would say happy Thanksgiving to you. And if you're around the world, we'll even wish you happy Thanksgiving around the world, too.
2020 does have things to be thankful for, so reflect on that.
It does. And we appreciate and we are thankful for you as listeners. So as we mentioned earlier during one of the breaks, we certainly invite you to take a peek at the at our website, www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Give us some feedback there and the other things that you can do. And I think we're obliged by, if not by law, at least by tradition, to close out the show a particular way, which is to remind you that if you happen to encounter a fork in time, what is our suggestion, Lex?
Take it.
Take it. Have a great day, guys.
Thanks for listening to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast. Learn more about the podcast at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Join us next time.